and girls, ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Hallengren. I'm from Sweden, and we are, as always, glad to have you with us. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceRadio.net is our websites where you can find more of what we do. Well, today on Red Ice Radio, we have Piero San Giorgio. He's a Swiss author and former businessman and software executive. For the past decade, he has studied the global economic system and its dependency on ever-expanding populations, debt, and resource exploitation. He's the author of several books, including the bestseller Survive the Economic Collapse, and we'll discuss how to do just that on this show. Welcome, Piero. Thank you so much for coming on with us today. Great speaking with you. Hope you're doing well.
Hi. Great. Great to speak to you.
Well, thank you so much. We have a lot to talk about today. Obviously, we want to get into the book, Survive the Economic Collapse. It's been, I think it's been out for about, is it almost 2 years now?
Yes, almost, in English at least.
Almost 2 years in English, all right. And obviously, I wanted to get into a bit more of what inspired you to start writing the book and maybe ask you a little bit about yourself in the beginning. But, however, we have to touch on the recent events of, I shouldn't laugh, perhaps, but of what happened in Paris. I know that I was in on your YouTube channel earlier today looking at some of your videos, and unfortunately I don't speak French, so I couldn't understand, but I know that you've covered it. I know that this is something that ties into what we'll get into later in reference to the book, but tell us your initial impressions of what you think this is all about, and if this is the future of France that we're looking at here.
Oh yes, we're definitely looking at the beginning of the future of France and the future of Europe, and mind you, even of some other countries in the, let's say, Western developed world. Funny enough, I did predict these events in a video that I made on July 7th, and that I only shared with some readers that I have in the French police and armed forces. And I was telling them that exactly the modus operandi, because of course, I'm also training as military, and of course, we understand the tactics of people who want to make such events. And I was telling my my contacts in the police and army and that they had to really make sure to check trains, concert halls, of course, grouping of people, and so on. And unfortunately, it happened. So actually, that video, July 7th, I did put it finally online as well. But certainly on the attacks per se, there's different layers of reading that you can have. The first layer of reading is basically the facts. The facts are that we have a growing number of population in Europe that is not from Europe. And among these people, some of them are Muslim. And among the Muslim population, there are people who are radicalized and basically eventually make terrorist attacks or attacks. And at least these are spectacular. And you can see those attacks, of course, as reported in the news, because they kill a lot of people. We obviously don't see the attacks that happen every day, which are often much more mundane and racist, but nonetheless extremely dramatic for the people who are suffering from beatings, murders, thievery, and rapes, and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if you look at these attacks in Paris, you basically see eight people who are living, who used to live in Belgium and France, who suddenly radicalize themselves and attack. And actually, it seems that one of them is actually one of the recent migrants from Syria.
Yeah.
Which obviously is not an economic or refugee. It was clearly a soldier sent to be part of these attacks. And of course, that what is also a fact is that these people have logistic background, have logistic support, and it is not just some people who take a knife. They have weapons, they have explosives, they have a logistics. And that leads me to the second point of view that you can take, the second analysis, which goes beyond the facts, which starts to be, why are these people attacking us? So one element, is, of course, is the religious element, but there are other elements. And the other element is maybe the people who run the Western world have been playing a little bit in the Middle East for the last 100 years. The English leadership, the French leadership, and a bit later in the 20th century, the American leadership, have been meddling in the Middle East. And where it links to what I write in my books is to ask, why are these oligarchy of that run the Western world meddling in the Middle East? There are many reasons, but one of the most interesting reasons, I believe, is that when you look at the current state of the world today and the deep trends that are going in the last 50 years, is that, of course, we have built a civilization, which is now global, that is based on very complex economies, very high level of wealth, very high level of consumption, very high level of commerce and transports and exchanges of goods and services across the world. And all of this comes down to oil. Oil, of course, a very important, very precious natural resource, which has been known to be, of course, not unlimited. It is finite, and it will run out eventually, so especially in places where it's very cheap. And it happens that the fate of sometimes there is irony in the fate of things, where suddenly in one of those backwards places in the world, like the Arabian desert, where suddenly you have a lot of oil. And that means that the control of the Middle East, where most of the oil and the inexpensive oil in the world has been found, and the British started to gun for the destruction of the Ottoman Empire because they knew that, especially in Mesopotamia, which is currently Iraq, there was lots of oil, in Kuwait, in Saudi. And so the control of this oil, or the denial of the control of this oil to other powers, like Soviet Union before, and then Russia, and of course China, brought this meddling in this region, which has always been a chaos, a very complex region to work in. So if you add this chaotic region plus, which is essentially tribal, and if you add the creation of Israel in that region after World War II, you come into a situation where these people, which happen to have moved by the millions in Europe, resent this meddling in their day-to-day life, which is very understandable. So we have to see both ways. In one way, we have been meddling into this region, and our governments have been so smart to bring millions of these people, which have tribal wars between themselves, which have a different culture, a different way of looking at life, of philosophy, of religion, and suddenly we bring them here, and suddenly we are surprised that they fight back and they attack us. So, in a way, I'm not seeing them as the problem.
Right.
I see them as a consequence of problems which are much deeper. And I do, of course, I do touch some of them in my books. But certainly, my analysis on this is that when we start to look at the root causes of this problem, bombing them back, as France did in the last 3 days, is exactly the same mistake as the United States did, of course, after 9/11, where invading Afghanistan and Iraq and killing close to 2 million people in the process over 15 years. Is exactly not the way to do it. But I think you and me and most of your listeners, they know that that is a reasoning of a sane person to
right.
say that this is not what you do. Of
yeah.
course, they wanted to do this because there are much more deep reasons, because you have to see, of course, who is the oligarchy that runs the world. And then when you discover that, you discover, well, actually, they don't care about creating chaos because they live in two very nice houses in protected areas. And when Arabs and Europeans kill each other, and when Africans are brought into Europe, and when people rape each other and so on, they don't care. They don't care at all.
No. It's remarkable, isn't it, that they are creating a situation where they claim they represent our, you know, they have to take care of our security. They have to do all these things, all these measures. I mean, I can just imagine what France is going to go through now in terms of potential legislation, more surveillance, you know, monitoring online, etc. As an excuse, of course, to say that, you know, we try to prevent these things from happening in the future. But if they were sincere about those things, they wouldn't have the borders wide open to begin with, right?
Of course. Any sane person would see what is the problem. And in fact, many people said exactly that for the last 40 years. And you know very well there's been people who have just simple, reasonable approaches to living economies and living societies. They've been labeled extremists, fascists, Nazis, anti-Semites, whatever. This labeling and this ostracization of people who just had the simple common sense was extremely strong. The good news is that because now the problems are biting us in the ass, if I can say that.
Yes.
Well, no one is you know, people don't care to be ostracized and to be called names. They will just voice, and you can see how politically you see new parties that are rising, or parties who are considered far right, but who are in fact extremely reasonable. They are rising and taking much more a presence in the politics. You see also people who are voicing what they think. And this is a very welcome, if you actually like the freedom and the fact that people can express their thoughts, this is a much welcome, change. And I think it will bring, a lot of changes unless it's too late. And I'm in between, and with my analysis, I'm a little bit in between. I think that this change is coming a little bit too late, because the damage has been done, and the civil war on a global scale is already starting, and therefore we have to prepare ourselves.
And what do you think is the what should we call that, the groupings, the various different interest groups that will be fighting here? Who are the player on this global chessboard, if you will?
Once again, you have to see at which altitude you are looking the map. On the very high level, first of all, it's very hard to know, because none of us, or at least not me for sure, is having breakfast with the people who run the world every day.
Right.
When I used to work in the business, I used to work 20 years in the software industry as a manager, as a business developer for, I worked in Africa, in the Middle East, in Eastern Europe, across a little bit the world. And actually that's why I saw the reality of the brutality and what is happening in the world. I mean, I was raised in Switzerland, and Switzerland is a very peaceful, very quiet country, still is. But when you travel across, you see the reality. People kill you for a piece of food.
Right.
People will, if you're not protected by your family or your brothers, they will rape you, etc., etc. This is what happens for billions of people in the world. It's brutal. It's ruthless. And civilization, the way we see it, is really not common across the world. And certainly the high-level oligarchy that runs the world, first of all, I'm not sure they really understand all the consequences of what they're doing. They always think that they're smarter. They always think they are better, and that they will get away from anything that happens. And history shows us that that's not the case. Often civilization fall, get destroyed, and they bring down everyone, including the people who rule it. And this was the case for the Roman Empire, for the Mayas, for the Aztecs, for parts of the Chinese empires that came and went. Civilization come and go, and I think we are at the beginning of the final fall of the global economy that we are used for the last 70 years, really. So that's the view you could see there on a very high level, and it's very difficult to know who's playing with who. I mean, what is the game that Russia is playing? I believe they are playing for the Russia. For the Russian people and country. But who can be sure? Maybe they are doing some deals that we don't know. Certainly in the United States, the government of the United States has not been playing for the American people for a long, long time, for at least 100 years.
Yeah.
And in Europe, we see, and people who know how European Union was created, for example, people who understand the links of, some guys like Kalergi or Jean Monnet. These people have created Europe to be a tool for the United States and a tool for domination of the, you know, difficult to manage European people. Let's admit that European people are difficult to manage because of our what makes us special. We are rational, we are inventive, we're strong, and then they had to destroy us through many, many means. And that is a plan that is quite long. If you go down towards the map on a very granular level, well, of course, what we see is consumerism. You see the having everything now instead of having delayed gratification, which used to be what was the norm before. Now we need everything immediately. When we want some pleasure, we can have it, whether it's food or porn or whatever. Everything is immediate.
Yeah.
And this has created generations after generations of people who are stupid, people who are who have no willpower, people who are even physically weak. And suddenly we mix these very weak Americans and Europeans with people who come from this part of the world that I know well, which are brutal, which are hungry. And they and in some way, the media have created a condition where we have programmed these people to hate themselves, to hate each other. And the media, with all these controversies about all these topics like feminism and race and everything, have created a situation where everybody hates everybody else. So when you ask, you know, if there's going to be a war, a civil war or conflict, unfortunately, it's going to be everyone against everyone.
Right.
Or at least, unless you get out of this logic.
Yeah, so it's like, I would suspect we would see groupings on many different levels. I think this is kind of the emergence of identity politics to a certain extent as well, that you that they've managed to divide people. I mean, where the various European nations previously were united as a people, this issue of immigration has been a very divisive one, obviously, driven like a wedge in between people. And I know even families that have falling out and friends that are, you know, not friends anymore because of this question. But my point is, you have probably groupings on many different levels. Everything from, as you said, I'm only the third wave feminists fighting for our cause, and I'm fighting for the cause of the furries. It's like, but that must be a luxury at this stage, right? Or at an eventual stage,
yes.
Because I mean, eventually we'll be basically the larger of a group you are, kind of like in tribal warfare in the past, right? That the larger group you manage to amass, the more security you're going to have to a large extent, right?
Absolutely, and you're right. I believe there's going to be a lot of divorces have been filed since last Saturday in France, because clearly you will have people who say, oh, these fucking whatever, Muslims, immigrants, whatever, and their wife will say, oh, no, you cannot say everybody together. You cannot put everyone in the same bag, da-da-da. And people start fighting. This is an example. And actually, I think that people who are smart or educated, who are curious to know and understand the things, must go beyond both these simple explanations. And as I said, I think that you can look at the facts and you can take conclusions of the fact. And in some ways, and really, believe me, I don't come from that far, from that part, but you can also understand that you look very silly when you say all migrants, all immigrants, all here, all there are doing something.
Well, that's just not true, obviously.
It is, indeed. So we have to be smart, because suddenly my job is to analyze and understand and give solutions to people. So clearly, if the solutions are based on the wrong analysis or too simplistic analysis, well, maybe you take the risk that these solutions are wrong, are not working. And in the end, what is really important is what is working, because we are, as every human being, every animal, every mammal, we are fighting for territory, resources, and reproduction. This is what makes us who we are.
We have moved on from that, Piero. We're more intelligent than that now, right?
Exactly, but this is only because we are rich. We are rich because we don't need the food. But here's something. You know, I named my book Survive the Economic Collapse, not the Civil War, not the end of oil, not the nuclear war between the United States and Russia. I call it the economic collapse. And for me, it was very important to show people that the nexus of what's going to happen, the element that is going to be key and crucial and fundamental, is the collapse of the economy. Because everything else has already collapsed. Look, I'm not a moralized guy. I'm not religious. I'm really not in the goal of telling people how they should live. But I must confess and I must look around me that the morals have collapsed. Everything that was the foundation of human societies for the last hundreds of thousands of years, which is the family, the tribe, common beliefs, genetic homogeneity to some certain extent, has collapsed. And you mentioned something very nice. How do we define ourselves? When you ask an American, what does it mean to be American? There is some sort of narrative and mythology that they can say, but when you look around them, it's not what they can see. There is a mythology in Europe about being nice and everybody is equal and everybody is the same and give them education, they will do well. Well, this is not what people see around them anymore. And what does it mean to be French today? You take the metro in Paris and it looks like suddenly you're into a very high-tech town in Africa. And this is, French people don't recognize their country anymore.
No.
And if you ask them, how do you define being French? No one has the same answer. And this is the success of this divisive culture that has been engineered and we have been put into, that no one knows anymore who it is. So we only have one fallback, is to be individualistic consumers. And this can work to some extent, and actually I kind of believe it doesn't work, because when you look at statistics of antidepressant drugs taking and the happiness level of people, it's very interesting to see that people in Africa, and again, I know very well Africa, people in Africa are much more happy than people in Europe or in the United States, for example. And even statistics show that. When you ask people, do you feel happy? And the guy has nothing, but he's very happy because he has a family, he knows he's part of a tribe, and he has pride into being part of that tribe, even if that tribe has customs of that tribe are to sit still. I know a tribe, for example, north of Chad, who are like gypsies. They are some sort of Sahelian gypsies, and they are very proud to be stealing on other people. Like gypsies have a pride because that's their culture. And you know what? I love them. I like these guys. I like all the culture of the world if they're on their territory, in their place. Because when you start to bring people everywhere, look, I'm against Europeans colonizing Africa. I'm against Africans colonizing Europe. I'm against Chinese colonizing Africa.
Right.
Everyone should be into their homeland with some exchanges, yes, with some freedom of commerce and so on. But anyway, what I like and what I want has no importance anyway, because what's interesting is to understand where we're going, and I'm afraid it's not what I like. I'm not going to places where I like.
No, exactly. I agree. I mean, how can you not agree in these days? I mean, our values, our morals have been utterly gutted, hollowed out, and we've had, many concepts, ideologies arising, especially since the Second World War's end, cultural Marxism, feminism, going against everything that has to do with tradition and everything else, and with the belief, of course, that we're somehow progressing, that this is heading in the right direction or whatnot. But it's evident now. I think the it's coming around on itself now, and we can see the full context of what these ideologies have brought, to the West, and also, of course, then people who are looking towards the West as some kind of, admiring factor. So it's very sad to see something like that. But I think the larger picture that you described to us is correct, and I think we have to look at it from that perspective, that things do rise and fall in nature. It's a natural thing. Although the manipulation, in my mind, has been artificial, it's been imposed upon us,
Yes. We
still have allowed it to happen for some interesting reason, right? So these are large cycles. And the question is, of course, is what we're looking at now ahead of us then. If this is going to collapse, you know, on the scale of what the Roman Empire kind of went through.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do? Where do we turn? How do we survive through all of this?
And this is exactly my theory, in the sense that if you want to survive something, you have to understand that something. You have to understand what is happening. This is why I kind of, and probably this explains the success of my books, especially in Europe. You know, my books have been translated in Italian, of course, in English. They came out in French, and they're also translated in Russian and even in Arabic. So what's interesting is that you have to understand the state of the world and the trends, where the trends are leading us. And I made the following constatations in the world. That's not an English word, but I'm sure you get what I mean.
I get what you're saying, yeah.
Okay. So the idea is that, first of all, we are 7.5 billion people. And when you see the growth of the population in the world, it's exponential. And it's not stopping. And it may grow a little bit less fast than it used to, because there is a demographic transition. Even in, for example, in North Africa, in Morocco, in Algeria, or Tunisia, they have the same birth rate as in Europe now. It's less than 2. Of course, in sub-Saharan Africa, it's still pretty high. It's still between 3 and 6, depending on the countries. But it's decreasing. But still, it's decreasing, but people are there. And therefore, the world population keeps growing. And the question we have to ask ourselves is that, before even we discuss of the, are these cultures compatible? What does it happen when we take 30 million people who are not European and you bring them into Europe? But even before that, is there going to be enough resources for all these people to,
mm-hmm, right,
to eat, to have clean water, to grow food and eat that food? And the answer is we're on the limit. We're on the verge of not having enough productivity in the soils around the world, because of soil nutrient depletion, because of the clean natural clean water scarcity, because it's a resource that is not infinite, and it takes time to be produced by nature. We also see that the growing number of people, you know, if everyone in the world wanted to live the lifestyle of a peasant of Mali or of North India, that would be okay. That's no problem.
Right.
But that's not what people want. In Africa, people have an incredibly growing lifestyle. And in fact, I would say that in Africa, most people live much better than immigrants in Europe today. In many, many countries, I know these places really well. In Kenya, the average guy makes a better living than the guy who's in Paris cleaning shit in the streets. It's a long story, but, mm-hmm, but definitely the people want to live better and they want to consume more. So they want cars and bicycles and houses with electricity and fridges and all over the world.
iPhones and iPads, yeah.
Yeah, everyone has an iPhone. In you see these migrants arriving.
It's amazing. I know, exactly.
And this is
selfie not, sticks. Sorry to interrupt, but I've been sending them with selfie sticks. amazing.
It's not the image of that we've seen. You know, I'm 40 years old. I remember when I was a kid to see these images of starving kids in Africa and so on. This is not the case anymore. Not on that scale suddenly, because. But all of this means that we're using natural resources, you know, from raw materials to, of course, the energy, the oil, as I mentioned before, which is probably the most important, across the world. And China, 1.5 billion people wanting to consume like Europeans or like Americans.
Yeah.
We're never going to make it. And when you look at the data of the scarcity, which I explored in the first parts of my book, the data on the scarcity of raw materials, of the levels of consumption, but actually more worrisome, the level of which the food that we grow has no nutrients anymore, because the soils are poor. The soils have been depleted of the nutrients that makes a tomato or taste and have the nutrients that a tomato is supposed to have, and so we cannot feed this growing number of people. We cannot give them the growth that they expect to have. And we are destroying through this consumption, because the byproduct of consumption is creation of pollution in many ways. We are destroying the natural habitats and the environment that is necessary to grow and feed the people. And therefore, we are creating chain reactions of destruction of the environment, inability to feed the people, which leads to scarcity of resources, which leads to fighting for the scarce resources, which leads to civil war, which leads to radicalization of the people, which leads to destruction, which leads that part of these people will migrate. And, you know, tell you the truth, the parts of the world who are suffering the most from migration are not exactly Europe or the United States. It's the parts that are the buffer zone. Indeed, Syria or North Africa, where they are the first one getting the people. And there's no welfare state in Morocco when the Africans arrive in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
They are beaten up. They are put into slavery. And even in Italy, and I was in Italy last week to do some conferences, I see that the mafia, the local mafias, especially in the south, they take these guys and they put them to work in the fields, in some little factories, and they put them into slavery. And it's brutal here again. So the turmoil that all of these movements are causing are gigantic. But it's not all. This is just part of it. The other part is that the Western world and the globalized economy is based on oil, sure, but it's also based on something else, which is debt. We are not able to create growth. We are not able to create any significant economy that can sustain all these problems that are piling up.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the economy is based on debt, and debt is based on nothing, on thin air. It's just some accounting trick that is done to create billions and trillions of dollars of debt. And you know, it's very easy to now, when I wrote my first book 4 years ago, it was not that obvious. Now everybody has seen these videos on the internet that explain how money creation is made through debt. And the consequence of that is we are creating the perfect storm of hyperinflation potential linked with massive migration of people, with all these scarcity of resources altogether, in which means that when there's going to be a spark, and this spark can be a financial meltdown, it can be a civil war somewhere, it can be a slowdown of China, it can be coming from many, many places. And when the spark puts the fire to the whole thing, I believe, and this is my theory, and I always say to people who read my books, you know, think for yourself, check the information I give you, think for yourself, because you need to be convinced of what's going to happen to really, really make the changes in your life for the solutions that I'm suggesting. Otherwise, you're not going to be convinced and you're not really going to do it. So the meltdown, which I call the economic collapse, because I don't see any other meaningful word, is very close and could lead us to a real collapse of civilization, like, indeed, as you mentioned, and as I believe, the Roman Empire, because I don't see any other similar, one could say very similar to the Maya Empire collapse, but no one knows the Maya Empire.
Right.
But certainly it is very similar also. And so we are going to have a lot of destruction, a lot of political crisis, which will lead to social crisis. And think of a collapse of the local European economies. You think that the welfare will continue? And when
for
example, in, I don't know, random data in Denmark, 75% of the immigrants are on welfare.
Yep.
75% don't work.
Yep.
You think they're going to say, oh, well, I don't get money from the state anymore. Now I'm going to start to be creative and become an engineer and becoming
No. They go underground, right? They find other ways of making money. They turn to criminality. They do all kinds of things. Whatever they have to do to survive, right?
So if we're lucky, in that scenario, our countries across the world, and we have to look at, you know, all Western type countries, Australia, New Zealand, United States, and Europe, of course, at best, they will become like Colombia, with mass poverty people who are predating on each other, and eventually also on the few people who are actually working and actually creating wealth. That's in the best scenario. That is, if we still have some economy that works. But I believe, it's my belief. I cannot prove that I'm right. It's just my belief, because I have this feeling that. The numbers show that when it collapses, it will go on a path of I think, pretty fast collapse.
Really? Yeah.
And it will kill most of the economy because, hey, we're not producing anything. We're not manufacturing anything. We're a service-based economy. So when service-based economy collapse, who's doing the fucking work? No one.
Yeah.
No one. So then you have nothing. And when you have nothing, you have to literally eat the people. And maybe I'm pushing this too far.
Soylent Green?
Well, that still requires manufacturing.
Right, yeah.
But certainly it means that we are going to have very significant turmoil. And to come back to one of the earlier questions, it could be everyone against everyone, unless, and I believe it's going to be so, people rediscover very quickly the links that create, because clearly there will be ethnic wars, as I've seen in Africa, very quickly, even in the cities where, you know, in African cities, the tribe element is not as strong as in the countryside. Well, in Rwanda, or even in Zimbabwe on a smaller scale, when things started to be bad, very quickly, people could ask help to people who are the only, from their own ethnicity. So in Europe, with the many, many different ethnicities, you have to fear that they are going to group into together, which doesn't mean that it's going to be, you know, whites against others. It's much more complicated than that. Because, for example, in Marseille, it's French, in a French town on Mediterranean, it's not that simple. For example, the Arabs and the people from sub-Saharan Africa, they don't like each other. They're not going to band together. They're actually going to fight.
Yeah.
In fact, you have, even in Switzerland, you have groups of people from the Balkans, from Kosovo, who are extremely upset with the people from Cap Verde. And which is one of the funny things about globalization is, how could people from Cap Verde ever meet and fight people from Kosovo if it wasn't for the globalized economy? It's just insane. And why they have to do it in my town? And slaughtering each other in my town. It's crazy,
ridiculous. Yeah, it's ridiculous. and the way that, you know, obviously then the European, the white man, has taken it upon himself, against most people's will, of course, but to somehow kind of police and oversee this and spend all our time, all our resources, all our efforts on trying to keep the peace. Because, I mean, let's face it, this is a completely artificially created situation, right? I mean, do you think that at the root of this, if we look at the economic incentives or excuses that we've gotten for as a reason for mass migration, they talk about declining birth rates and they talk about these people being on one level economic migrants because they seek a better life, right? But at the same time, this is somehow, these people are brought into our countries to try and kind of make sure that our economic system can perpetuate itself, but nothing is indicating that this is actually happening. It's just basically destroying the welfare system quicker, right?
Of course, it's complete propaganda. And I tell you, there is the process that has been put by the left, let's say, or what in America you would say the liberals, which is not the same, as you know, in Europe, the liberals are more economic liberals. All of this is, I think it's the real racist, the real mépris, the word in French, when the people who despise the people across the world are these leftists. They have this paternalistic approach. They see these people as helpless savages. And they say that it's, of course, they have this, all this guilt trip on the white man. The white man is so powerful that try to make a white-only club into any city in the world and see how powerful white man is. But besides that, this approach to say that these savages need to come here because they are going to replace, because they are humping and making more children and all that. I find this extremely racist, in fact. And I think one of my theories is that the most racist people in the world are the anti-racist and the people from the left, because not only they are racist against themselves, but actually they see these people from all over the world just as tools for their political agenda. They don't care about them.
Right.
But I think this is not the topic of any of my books, but certainly something that I think is relevant to understand today's world. But more sad is that we are bringing in Europe and in the United States, and perhaps even more in the United States because there's less welfare in the United States, people are actually fairly hardworking compared to the people who are not migrating. So in fact, this system has deprived a lot of developing countries with fairly good people who could have developed their countries more and better. And it's quite sad when you see some countries like Mali, for example, that have more doctors in France than in their own country from their own nationals.
Mm-hmm.
So we are this system of sucking up the best brains, and a lot of people are not best brains. Don't get me wrong, but certainly we have picked up some of the best brains of these countries. And some of the most hardworking, and to be fair, because I'm fairly balanced, I believe, in my approach. For example, I give the example in my book of how the Italian mafia has destroyed Somalia, and people say, "What? I thought it was the United States and the bombings." And no, you have to go much farther. People need to know that, for example, the German chemical industry has subcontracted to the Italian the mafia from Napoli. The Camorra, the treatment of the chemical waste from the German industries. Now, the Italian Camorra, so from Napoli, they're not treating the waste. They're putting it into old, like, Liberty ships from World War II. So that was very strong in the 80s. They're putting the chemicals into old World War II Liberty ships. They would sail them off the coast of Somalia, which was really a small state with no army, no power, and they would sink them there, and that's it. So obviously what would happen is that the fishermen of Somalia would have no fish anymore because all the waters were toxic. And that's how they turned into pirates. So all the things come back to bite us, and now we have Somalians into Sweden, into Germany, into Nordic countries. This is the place where they want. They don't come so much into Southern Europe, but they come to those places and creating all sorts of problems. So you see, this is why in the globalized economy, if you think short term, as of course the German chemical industry did, as the mafia, of course, and they don't care about no one, did, well, it comes back to bite you eventually. And this is, by the way, a very... something that in the 60s already the original ecologists, and even if you look at before the ecologists in Germany of the 19th century and early 20th century, they already understood that, and they already warned people against meddling into other countries' development. Everyone right. should develop within their own means, and when you start to have things like I just explained, you end up having toxic waste from Germany through the Italian mafia into Somalia. Well, eventually it comes back to you because we're not in the 19th century where the Somalians just die. Now they move.
Well, see, and also let me mention something to that. Let's remember where you were so we don't break that up too much, your flow there, where you wanted mm-hmm. to go with that. But just, I wanted to mention as well that these companies, they happen to be maybe in Germany these days, but obviously they don't represent the interests of the German people, right? These are very selfish interests. They are... driven by profits. Many of these companies, they are transnational. They're bigger than some, nations, GDP these days, right? So it's like, my point is, the German people are ended up taking the brunt end of this for something that a few people did that don't have them. It's kind of like the political system, I guess, ultimately. This is a no-brainer, but I just wanted to mention that.
Oh, yes, completely. And in fact, what's interesting is that I should also say, because let's not just bash the leftists. Let's also bash the right. Or the economical conservative right. Because in the 70s, they are the ones who said, well, how about we bring, because, you know, especially in Northern, well, in Germany, in England, and in many places, they started to say, well, look, the Italian workers, the Spanish workers, that's all right, but they cost too much. How about we start bringing some people who cost less for some, of course, very low-wage jobs? And they are the ones who said, well, we should bring their families because, therefore, they will not go away and they will create pressure on the syndicates to lower the labor costs and lower the wages, and which was successful. And when you look at the data, you actually see that since the end of the 1970s, there has been no economical real need for any foreign workers in Europe or in the United States, if only to create more unemployment by bringing lower wage and lower paid people. So in fact, at the root of that, you also have indeed the business parts of the industry and the politicians that have started this. But it's, you know, at some point, I'm beyond the finger pointing. It's interesting to analyze, but I'm beyond the finger pointing because what's going to happen? Because here's the thing: today's world is so complex that when you look at most people who live in cities or certainly lives an urban way of life, we are dependent of incredibly complex systems that and supply chains that provide food, water, utilities, medicine, supplies for your car, for the hospital, for any industry that still exists. All of this is incredibly integrated, and it's working just in time with no stores, with no reserves, with no inventory. That was the word I was looking. And this is something you can see very well when there is a natural catastrophe. When Hurricane Sandy hits New York, immediately there's no water, no oil, no electricity, no food in the stores, and it was the same in Japan. What makes a difference is the culture of the place you live in. For example, in Japan, when the tsunami hits them in February 2011, you have 30,000 deaths, you have incredible destruction. And what do the Japanese do? They line up, they clean the place, they take away the bodies, they get the supplies and the relief that happens, and they rebuild. They don't say a word. There's no looting, no rioting.
Mm.
Another example: Hurricane Katrina in the United States, in New Orleans.
Yeah.
First thing, you know, even before the hurricane happens, you already had people taking the guns and shooting in the markets to loot. And for some of the smarter ones, they were not even looting for water or food. They were looting for hi-fi stuff.
Yeah, big screen TVs.
And scooters and shoes. Okay, so the level of IQ of the place you are and the culture that you're living in makes a big difference on how people react. And once again, it comes back to what we're saying. It's going to be everyone against everyone because there's no single culture. It's just going to be a mess. And believe me, people in Dakar, Senegal, will react better than people in Paris. Because in Dakar, Senegal, you have two tribes, you have two ethnicities, not 50. And so eventually, you know, there will be a little bit of looting, but they will say, look, now we have to find a solution. Okay, we are hungry, we are cold or whatever, or hot in that place, but we find a solution. In the places where there are 50 people, no one gives a fuck about anyone else. And we have been formatted by TV, which is, in the end of my book, I say, if you want to do at least one thing, is get rid of your TV.
Mm, oh yeah.
Certainly, we have been formatted by our habits, by our other media, by the look at this week, how people are, because I never watch media, I never read news, and I had to this week because I want to look for some facts on what happened in Paris. And everyone is talking about, what, two women fighters, boxing women, right. One beat the other, or the other interesting fact it seems in newspaper is that Martin Sheen has AIDS.
Who the biggest fuck? News ever, right?
Exactly, yeah. And this is exactly the kind of things that pollute our brain and take bandwidth away from thinking, away from seeing the reality, and away from doing what we need to do to not die in the next 5 years.
Well, very interesting discussion. Obviously, I have much more to ask you about. In the second segment, I want to ask you more about basically, both when you believe this is going to start to unravel at a greater pace, obviously, what can be done about it? I want to hear more about what you write about in the book in terms of what people can do about this preparation. What should they do? You know, there's tons of stuff to go into here. So let's get to that in a second. But before we take a break here, Piero, give us the details about, your website, your YouTube channel. Tell us where people can go to, obviously, pick up a copy of the book. And if there's anything else, like upcoming or something, you'd like to let us know about.
Sure. So, well, people can look. I'm a bit guilty. I spend quite some time of instead of making a blog, I run stuff on my Facebook, and I do some video blogs on my YouTube, and some of them are in English. But certainly, people can find my book on Amazon, Survive the Economic Collapse. You can also check my website, which is piero.com, but there's not a lot in it. It's just that I do some consulting as well. So people want to know a little bit more about what I do for some people. They can check my website, but I think the starting point is clearly my book. My third book, which is about a woman and crisis. Will come out in English soon. I mean, in probably a few months. So I'm quite happy that another of my books will be translated in English. It was already translated in Russian, but there's going to be some interesting things because we need to also help women. It's half of the population.
Absolutely, yeah, that's
the better looking half.
That's right. I totally agree with you there. All right, yeah, exactly. Survive the Economic Collapse is the book we're talking about. We're going to have links up to that, both to Amazon and also to Piero.com. And then you have Survive the Collapse.se, which actually is a Swedish domain.se. So that's a good way of writing that out. Survive the Collapse, but with a dot between the last two letters in there. All right, well, very good. Thank you so much for the first segment. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Piero. We'll be right back with more. Second segment with Piero, we continue looking at the potential variables of an economic collapse, including decreasing oil production, scarcity of nutritious food, and lack of potable water. Piero illustrates how the U.S. government's disastrous foreign policy and the financing of its military-industrial complex fully demonstrates the magnitude of the crisis at hand. Then he breaks down the way to conceptualize a global financial collapse and how to prepare by being rooted in both the physical ground and one's own traditions and culture. Piero covers seven elements for developing autonomy and living a sustainable way of life, securing a water source, growing food, practicing self-reliant hygiene and health, understanding energy technology, honing skills and knowledge, and preserving culture for future generations, and of course defense of yourself and also your family, and building strong social bonds. Don't miss this important continuation. And if you're not yet a member, you can go to redicemembers.com and sign up. Get instant access to over 1,000 radio shows, videos, inside episodes, and more. It's only €5 per month, and we have 3-month recurring subscriptions or one-time payments from 3 months all the way up to 2 years available. You can stream or download from the website or listen on your mobile device. You can add our feeds to your favorite podcast app or podcatcher on your mobile device and get some Red Ice to go. I hope you'll join us in the next segment. Some practical advice is coming up that you definitely don't want to miss. We're going to be back, by the way, with Matthew Heimbach and Jack Sen on Friday regarding Matt's exclusion letter from the UK by a special order from the Home Secretary, Theresa May. It's no problem to let in unknown migrants that could be terrorists disguised as refugees into European and British soil. But, you know, hating white supremacists and Nazis like Matt, who actually care for the Europeans' interests, no. Forget about it. People like him does not represent the values that the United Kingdom stands for. So we'll bar him from entering, but we'll let in anyone else that wants to come, literally. I think that right there, folks, should tell you everything that you need to know about our world today and how upside down it is. And everything is about catering to foreign interests by these traitorous politicians and not to their own people that they're supposed to represent and care for. They'll be ready and willing to risk a terrorist attack in a heartbeat while they are genuinely concerned, it seems like, with someone like Matthew Heimbach. Absolutely fascinating times, isn't it? Welcome to the new age of anti-white politics. But that's on Friday, Black Friday of all days, but we'll continue right now with the second hour of Piero San Giorgio's. So subscribe at redicemembers.com. You're invited to join, comment on the show, let us know what you think. We'll see you there. Thank you for listening.